This Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. This almost election day, in fact, this next week, a week from Tuesday, is election day. And some of the columns that Eye on the Pie, that Morton Marcus puts out lately, have dealt with the election and some thoughts about the election as well. And we have Morton with us from Indianapolis. Thank you for joining us today.
Certainly. My pleasure.
Well, the first, back to the latest column, actually, it came out today, is entitled, Is Indiana Better Off Than 4 Years Ago? And I guess it's the time, I suppose, that not only are the incumbent office holders hoping for the best, but the challengers are hoping that they can knock off the incumbents by showing things aren't as good as the incumbents claim it is. Tell us first about your thoughts about, I guess, how really important the issues of per capita personal income can be on a not only a statewide but a regional context.
Well, I think that that everyone knows that economic factors are very important in an election. It was in the what was it, the 1992 election, Bill Clinton against George H.W. Bush, where somebody said it's the economy, stupid. You know, a lot of other issues may be out there, but the economy is very important about how people feel. And if you just look at Indiana and you ask yourself, you know, how are people doing? How are we doing as a state? Real per capita personal income, which means we take the income that people have from all sources. You know, it's wages, but it's also Social Security. And it's the assistance that they get from Medicare or Medicaid, all those kinds of things, dividends on stock ownership, interest in the bank, all these kinds of income. You put that together for the whole state and you factor out inflation and you get real personal income. And then what you want to do is okay, I got that stopped. I'm sorry about those bells in the background. That's why it's called bells.
You're a very, very busy and very influential person. Even though
No. These are people who want to sell me health insurance.
Oh.
Or want to change the roof on my house or something like that.
Well, they can talk to you another day, right?
That's what I'm hoping.
Yes.
That's right, because I love to get those phone calls and tell them that I wish they had a better job. Anyway, if you look at personal income on a per capita basis, that means you take all the people in the state of Indiana, men, women, children, whatever you've got, and divide personal income by the number of people. What you find is that Indiana is not growing as fast. After we adjust for inflation, is not growing as fast between 2015, 4 years ago, and 2019, as is the nation. 1.8% for Indiana, 2.1% for the nation. And you say, well, that's only, you know, 0.3 of a percentage point. But those 0.3 of a percentage point comes out to $575 for every resident in the state. Now, if you've got a family of four, we're talking about something over $2,100. So it's not an insignificant amount of money that we're talking about, but because we didn't grow at the average rate. I'm not talking about being one of the superstar states. I'm talking about just being average in the nation. So that's one of the measures that we look at. Another measure that we look is, you know, how are we doing on wages? We hear all these stories about how the state and the local economic development people are out there and they're trying to bring good-paying jobs to Indiana. Well, the question is, how well have they done over the past 4 years? And the average wage in Indiana was $56,000 a year. And you got to remember that takes into account all the people who make a lot more money, and that has a heavy weight as you get out there. You know, a person making $1 million it takes a lot to offset that with the people who are making under $25,000. We rank 27th in the nation, which is, you know, it's we're right in the middle again. But we're less than the nation. We're less than all of the other states in the Great Lakes. Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin are above us. Only Illinois, and I throw in Kentucky as well, because Hoosiers are always concerned about how are they doing in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And as long as Kentucky is not doing as well as we are, we think we're fine. But the issue here is that we're not keeping up. Well, then maybe what we should look at is just the number of jobs, because we know that jobs are the things that politicians talk about the most. And so if you look at the number of jobs in the state of Indiana, and you go back 4 years from this past September, go back to September 2015, we've had a 1% increase in the number of jobs. The nation had a 1.6%. Now, again, that sounds like just a small difference, but it adds up to an awful lot of jobs. That is, we're just not keeping pace with the nation in these three particular things. Now, I know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. and that is the folks who are in office, Democrats or Republicans, are going to go out and they're going to find two or three numbers where their city or their county or the state is doing better than somebody on something, and they'll bring this point up. It's a game that we play, and I've put out here three numbers that I think are important for the welfare of the people of the state. That's all we got there.
I know you spent a column talking about the economic leaders and losers, and you mentioned Northwest Indiana, for example, other counties in central Indiana, of course, in the list too. But to mention even here in Northwest Indiana that we're leaders, but some counties are doing better than others.
Well, sure. Lake and Porter County were among the leading counties in the state. Now, I define a leading county in this case as a state that did well in three particular measures: number of jobs, the growth of actual business establishments, places where you can buy things, places where you can work, and wages. And when you look at it on a county level, I just talked about it on a state level, mm-hmm. but you look at it on a county level over a 10-year period of time. Well, Lake County and Porter County are among the very few counties in the state. There are only 16 counties that had at least 1% growth in all three of those factors: wages, establishments, and jobs. And I, quite frankly, I was surprised. I didn't know that Lake County and Porter County were up there with the leading counties in the state. Now, they may not have very high growth, and that's one of the things we ought to look at also. But the fact is that they did have growth in all three of those factors, and I think that's an important factor. We don't find that in LaPorte County. We don't find that in Newton or Jasper. They did not have the same kind of growth. And we're in the state, we only had six counties that didn't do well, and all of them are in southern Indiana, mm-hmm. Down along the river or down along the Wabash River. That's where most of the problems are in the state, are in the southern part of the state.
I know among the columns that you put out here recently, Morton, talking about issues involving jobs and the like, you've kind of talked a little bit about that in the look here at the jobs that the politicians like to take up for their discussion and the campaigns. But you talk about jobs of the future. It was an interesting column talking about the fact that we have a generational gap of sorts, certainly changes over the generations that kind of make up what now are going to be the jobs of the future. Will you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. One of the things that I'm concerned about, in fact, I'm going to be in Fort Wayne talking to about 300 students tomorrow on this very subject, mm-hmm. Is that there are a lot of people out there who are spreading fear because they are of our generation, yours and mine, or younger even, and they're spreading fear among young people that, well, you know, you're going to have a tough time getting a job, and it's not going to be a job that you have for a lifetime. Well, who says having the same job for a lifetime is good for a person? One of the things we do find out is that people burn out. That's certainly true with teachers, and it's true in many, many other areas as well. People get tired. Last night, I was talking with a psychologist who's going to cut back from holding office hours, 8 hours a day, cutting back to 6 and then cutting back to 4 because it's just too much emotional strain for her. So people do get tired of the jobs they have, and changing jobs is not a bad thing. We've got this whole fear of technology. Technology is going to come in and take your job. That's exactly right. Technology has come in and taken jobs. I remember when they started putting elevators, automatic elevators, not elevators with a person inside moving the handle from left to right to make the car go up or down, but they got rid of elevator operators because they figured out a way that people could just come in and press the button to the floor they wanted to go to. Well, a lot of people lost jobs. Now we hear 35 million truck drivers are in danger of losing their jobs. Not tomorrow, not in the next 5 or 10 years. And the other thing is that many truck drivers will still be around for local deliveries because the vehicles that they're driving have to be driven with such precision that you can't trust an automatic system. So it may be 15, 20, 30 years before we see those truck drivers out of work. This is not something that we should fear. This is something we should recognize as a good thing. You know, why should somebody be stuck in a metal box all day? Why should somebody be working in an elevator all day? It just doesn't make sense. It's not good for the human spirit to be stuck in a metal box taking money as a parking lot attendant. You know, these things need to be changed. And I think what's going to be very important in the future is your ability to relate to other people, your ability to communicate, your ability to read and write and speak, and particularly your ability to have empathy. And that means that people who are holding jobs that involve working with other people, people who are nursing home aides, people who are school teachers, people who are even attorneys and possibly even people who work on radio, you know, might be able to develop real contact with people because they do have the ability to read and write, to speak, and to empathize with other people. The situation in radio that we have today is so much of the radio stations are basically mechanical. Mm-hmm. They're not the radio that I know. I used to do a radio program myself 5 days a week for 5 minutes, and I did it for 4 years, and it was wonderful because the feeling that I had was I was talking to one person, just one person. I didn't know what he or she was doing. They might have been washing dishes, or they might have been mowing the lawn, or who knows what, but I was talking to just one person. And that's there's a very great intimacy to radio that we find missing in so many of these radio programs, these stations that have no contact with people.
Yeah. Well, Morton,
excuse me for preaching.
Well, that's all right. Thank you very much. I'm glad at least you got your sermon in here, and we've run out of time for today. That's, as you know, that's the way it is with live radio. We have the clock
Absolutely.
On the wall, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we Absolutely. Certainly appreciate you spending some time and talking about the issues that keep us up to date on the economy, and certainly in this case here, how they're going to pertain to the elections, and even looking
right.
ahead. And we'll talk about some more things, too, that are coming up involving the economy and the elections ahead and even into 2020 and next time we get together. Thank you very very much for being with us today, Morton.
Thank you.
Mort Marcus bye-bye. Is an Indiana-based economist and writer, and he is also a columnist as well. Hits his eye on the pie columns that we talk about here on Regionally Speaking. And while we're talking about the elections coming up here, we have early voting that's finishing up here in Lake County this week and around Northwest Indiana. And the numbers that came in as of last week show that more people are taking advantage of the convenience. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked recently with Leanne Angerman. She is the assistant director for the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration about how many people seem to be coming out early to vote and where they are able to do so while the early voting is still on and when they can vote as well. Here's a conversation.
So how many people have voted early so far in person, by mail, and by email?
In person, by mail, and by email. In person, we're at 2,813. We have 31 by travel board. We have 425 by mail. And email, we have 3.
What is a travel board?
Travel board, we send out 1 Democrat, 1 Republican, and 1 voting machine. They will visit people who are confined to their home or a care facility, and they will physically take the voting machine out to them so they can vote.
And
so
how
it's a
many
special application that people complete for that, but they'll cover the nursing homes and people who are just confined to their individual homes. It's a travel board application. It's different from the mail-in absentee application. It's a travel board application that asks for the travel board to come and visit them wherever they're confined so they can vote. They have to qualify for it.
How long has this travel board been in existence?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, since I've been around, but I'm not sure if there are how long when that law was enacted.
How many early voting precincts are there in Lake County?
Early voting precincts? All of them. 353. How many early voting locations? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
11.
Can you give me the locations or generally and the hours?
Yes. Well, the first location is here in our office at the Board of Elections at the Lake County Government Complex. And their hours mirror our hours, so they're a little bit extended from all the other locations. And then all of them are open on Thursday nights until 7. So outside of the Board of Elections office, we have the East Chicago County Courthouse, the Gary Genesis Center, Hammond County Courthouse, Hobart Police Command Center, the Lowell Town Hall, Munster Town Hall, Sherrillville Town Hall, St. John Township Assessor's Office, Wicker Park Social Center, and Winfield Town Hall. And their hours throughout the week are 9 to 3. On Thursdays, they're open until 7. The last two Saturdays, October 26th and November 2nd, they're open from 9 to 2. And the last day for early voting is Monday, November 4th, from 9 a.m. until noon. And then Election Day is the next day on November 5th.
When did early voting begin?
I would also have to look up that law and find out when it started. Since I've been here, we've always had it. Mm-hmm. So I would have to look back at the law and find out when it started. I'm not sure.
How long have you been there?
Year and a half. But I think we've been doing early voting for years.
So what is there anything special that people need to know about voting this particular time around?
About voting this particular time around, I would say a couple of things. These are municipal elections. So those who are just in the unincorporated areas, the township areas, they don't have an election this time around if they are not in a city or town. One thing that we kind of like to bring people's attention to is when you have a situation where it's an at-large race, where it's a pick two or pick three, straight party voting doesn't apply to that. So if you would go in and press your straight party ticket, and in your ballot you have the option for a pick two or pick three scenario where you're choosing two people for an at-large position, they simply won't be selected. You actually need to go through the pages of your ballot and select them, and then at the end you hit your cast vote button.
What is an at-large position, again?
It would cover all of the districts of one community. So where some communities have a ward and you are sometimes only elected by that ward, or you have to be representative of that ward to qualify to run, an at-large position can be anywhere in the city or town and are voted on by the entire city or town.
Anything else that you can tell me about voting that maybe people don't know or that I should know to include in this story?
I would say one thing that is helpful to understand is that for early voting, all of the early voting locations have all of the precincts programmed into them. So you can go to any of the 11 early voting locations, regardless of where you live.
That's good to know. Wasn't there a law recently enacted where people have to show ID to vote? Was that always a thing, or is that something pretty new?
It is not really that new. That would have come in under Todd Rokita when he was Secretary of State, which was 2002 to 2010. So it was somewhere in that time frame that voter ID came into effect.
Thanks a lot, Leanne. I really appreciate your help.
Not a problem. You have a good day.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson speaking with Leanne Angerman. She is the Assistant Director for the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration. After a recycling drop-off center closed earlier this year in West Lafayette, local officials there had to struggle to find a way to be able to meet the demand from residents. The closures happened to coincide with the nationwide upheaval as China stopped accepting materials from the United States for recycling. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Taylor Haggerty tells us in the first of a two-part series, recycling advocates say that education is the first step toward a better future for the industry of recycling in Indiana.
China's decision not to accept recyclables has had far-reaching effects, with major recycling centers closing or halting operation in multiple states. Despite being a landlocked state that didn't do much work with China, Indiana has also felt the impact. China's decision has created a glut in the market, so even if facilities process materials, they may not have any buyers.
No commodity put in the recycling bin was untouched by that oversupply that then caused the value of those materials to plummet.
That's Indiana Recycling Coalition Executive Director Allison Mitchell. Mitchell says the recycling sent to material recovery facilities, businesses responsible for sorting and selling product, are often contaminated and can't be processed.
As a country, and probably as a global society, we got pretty lazy about enforcing, you know, what to put in the bin and even more importantly, what not to put in the bin.
And in Indiana, that lack of recycling education is hurting the entire industry. Tippecanoe County's recycling program will cost the county $70,000 next year, according to County Commissioner Tom Murtaugh, in part because the materials being processed and sold aren't worth enough to cover operation costs.
Hopefully going to receive a little bit of revenue back, but it will no way offset the cost of actually running the recycle program.
Following the West Lafayette closure, residents not enrolled in city curbside pickup plans must go to a site on Lafayette's north side if they want to recycle or travel to satellite pickup stations. And Murtaugh says they have.
When we compare numbers, there hasn't been a drop-off in the amount that they're seeing. So we're very excited about the fact that people have not stopped recycling.
Even so, the shift has caused some problems. The satellite locations have a high contamination rate, with some residents dumping items like plastic sheds or construction debris. The county passed an ordinance fining anyone dumping unsanctioned materials at the drop-off centers. But County Recycling Coordinator Amy Kristen Presson says it may not be clear what's allowable.
It's a learning curve on figuring out what's the right way to recycle. We can't just throw everything in the bin and hope that somebody figures it out. We have to figure it out from here.
Kristen Presson says residents tend to make assumptions, often relying on the numbers printed on plastics. She says officials could make it clearer still.
So saying bottles and jugs, that really limits what people are going to think about. They're not going to try to put a plastic toy in there. That's not a bottle or a jug.
Those guidelines will be communicated through signs and labels at the drop-off centers. But while signs are in place at the rural sites, they haven't been constructed at the North 9th Street facility.
So I'm already seeing some like black trash bags full of stuff, which you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to just throw it in there loose.
Inside the warehouse, a mountain of mixed recycling brought in from the curbside program sits in a pile, waiting to be compacted and transported to a materials recovery facility rather than sorted on site. The on-site bins are confusing too, most of them not labeled. According to the Recycling Partnership's Senior Director of Strategy and Research, Scott Mao, officials need to directly engage with residents to eliminate contamination, and the decision to start recycling has to be community-wide.
Everybody has to decide at that community level whether they want to do curbside recycling, whether they want to, you know, take on the costs of that program, and then how to do it.
Mao says the financial burden isn't a reason to stop recycling. He says communities need to see it as a public service, just like trash collection.
Garbage doesn't pay for itself either. You know, when you put garbage into a garbage truck and take it to a landfill, nobody's paying you to put the garbage there. You get charged to put that garbage into the landfill or incinerator.
And Indiana Recycling Coalition's Allison Mitchell says if Indiana can come to view recycling as an opportunity instead of a financial burden, it can bring investment and growth into the state.
When we have a robust recycling program on par with other states, we can compete from a broader quality of life standpoint.
The Indiana Department of Environmental Management has approved a study to analyze the industry's strengths and weaknesses. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Taylor Haggerty.
In part two of the series tomorrow, we'll look at what kinds of changes Indiana might make to adapt to and benefit from the new landscape involving recycling. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In a busy section of Maryville, Indiana, is a quietly operating business which has picked up some very important notoriety lately. The company we're referring to is SimCorp Incorporated, which is a cybersecurity company. We have the president and CEO of the company of SimCorp Incorporated, Robert Johnson III, with us. Thank you for stopping by here in the studios and talking about the business and this very important piece of information that we've got about how SimCorp has gotten to become one of the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in the country and around the world for 2020. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about SimCorp Incorporated, how you got started, It's a very busy company, very quietly operating, but very busy, certainly these days with all the problems that we're encountering with cybersecurity.
Sure. Well, we actually started in 1997, and initially we were focused on doing process automation and control, and that was actually automating manufacturing facilities. Mm-hmm. And while working in that space, one of the opportunities that we identified was that it seemed like it was possible without much effort to jeopardize the integrity of the manufacturing process or those critical machines that actually run our processes. So that encouraged us to develop the first version of our software, which at the time was called SimTrack Industrial, and the name of our product in general is called SimTrack. And that product helped identify unexpected changes to systems that help run manufacturing processes, those specialized computer systems.
Were you finding back then in these early days of the company that, and since you're talking about industrial processes, that these were probably processes that might have been put onto, we'll just say, a floppy disk? You know, the technology was very simple back then compared to what it is now. It was not as much on the internet-based systems as we have today, was it?
Not quite. But still, you had some of these control system networks being connected to the internet.
Right.
You also, and really the threat point at the time were USB sticks and laptops being carried throughout the organization. And what was the possibility that that laptop was infected and somehow altering, you know, how those manufacturing processes actually worked? Now, we ended up morphing over time and extending outside of that process automation realm into the general enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that was a big shift for us. But the mentality stayed the same. You know, we've always been of the mind that processes are critical and mission critical, in fact. And because of that, when we developed our software and targeted towards the general enterprise, this had that same thought process. How do we ensure business continues to run?
Did you find that over the years that you branched out from industrial into other business ventures, that the problem was still there? In fact, it got worse because of the fact that it was so easy to break into systems and infect them somehow or another. And did you find that there wasn't any real difference between, say, the processes in a factory or a manufacturer as to those in, say, in a major business?
No, the problem was really the same. And what we do is we actually detect unexpected changes to devices and servers and network devices. And if it changes, we let you know about it. And then here's where this process automation mentality kicks in.
Yeah.
we can automatically fix it, and our software can change things back to how they actually were before the attack. You mentioned things morphing over time. You know, I remember when we started, we were looking at about 78,000 threats a day, new types of malware, new types of threats every day. And but then about 2014, we hit 348,000 new types of malware, new threats a day. And as of today, we're well beyond 1.2 million new variants of malware every day.
Do you find that these are new ideas, or that the whoever's out there hacking, finding ways to break into the systems? Or do you find just maybe different versions of the same sort of malware that has developed over time?
That's a good question. It's actually a combination of both. There are always new ideas out there and new ways to exploit systems. However, we've also hit this point in time where there's an entire economy that's based around actually selling malware that can be customized by the purchaser, the person purchasing that tool may not have a high level of technical ability. So now this has become, becoming more of a commodity to an extent.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, the organization that put SimCorp Incorporated on the latest list, the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in the world in 2020, how did they find out about you folks, and how did they in turn determine that you were best suited for the list this year?
Well, Cybersecurity Ventures does an analysis of the entire security market. So their analysts and folks are constantly reaching out to understand your product, how it fits into the security space, and a problem that it solves. So this entire process is based on merit, and they take into consideration not only the leadership, the innovation in the company, but they also speak with customers and analysts to help make that final determination.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, in turn, they found out about you? Certainly by keeping an eye on businesses, probably from recommendations from other businesses. How do you rank with the big boys out there, seeing as, I guess, your company, and there's one other company I noted on the list that's based in Minneapolis. So you have only two in the entire Midwest, and then we have a number of course, in the United States and around the world. How did it come out that you're on the list this year?
Well, I'm happy to be part of that short list. Mm-hmm. But you're right, most of the companies on that list are quite large, and but we've been holding our own. I think that we have a culture of innovation at SimCorp, and a lot of that's driven just by the general culture to me in the Midwest, particularly here in Northwest Indiana.
Did you find Northwest Indiana as being not only a good place to establish a business, but to be able to grow over time? Because I suppose you could have taken your business to Chicago, or you could have been in one of the suburbs, but Northwest Indiana is where you're based.
Right, right. Well, I grew up here in Northwest Indiana, and the easiest path for it would have been to start a business out in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But we really wanted to make an impact here in Northwest Indiana. We're trying to make this shift from a manufacturing economy to a services type of economy, and we can only do that if we all individually participate in making that possible. And on top of it all, if you look at the resources that we have right here in Northwest Indiana, the human resources, they're really outstanding. There's certain things that you can't get in many other areas of the country. And that's, for instance, loyalty, the culture of hard work, where you know that this person is going to actually work that 40 hours, and to be honest, they'll probably work 60. So that culture of getting things done and keeping a practical attitude about how you accomplish things, I think is unique to this area, and I think contributes to our success.
Did you find that the people here in Northwest Indiana, in particular, as you mentioned, they're the kind that will work hard and develop themselves as well as the business along the way, that it's made it easier to be able to find more folks to make the business grow?
I think it does. It makes it easier, but also it reduces the stress of high turnover. If you look at other areas of the country, turnover is extremely high in the IT sector, and we have relatively low turnover. And I think a lot of that's because of the level of loyalty and the general culture that we're able to maintain here in the Midwest.
Now, looking into the future for SimCorp Incorporated, and we don't want you to give away any trade secrets, certainly, but what areas do you see that are out there that you'd like to see the company, if they're not already into working on, but to be able to get into to help in the cybersecurity area?
Well, you know, the mission of our company is to help you detect unexpected changes throughout your IT infrastructure. So we're constantly working to expand on what we're monitoring throughout your infrastructure. Right now, yes, we're monitoring servers and network devices and industrial controllers. Mm-hmm. But we'd also like to extend that to other items, for instance, industrial Internet of Things and Internet of Things configurations, because that's where we're going to see a lot of growth over time.
Well, congratulations for SimCorp Incorporated picking up the honor this year by being chosen by the Cybersecurity Ventures and in Cybercrime Magazine, I think is what they publish as well, and being on the list this year of the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in not only the United States, but in the world. And we hope that you'll get to be back on the list for 2021.
Well, we hope so as well, and thank you so much for bringing me on your show.
Robert Johnson III is the president and CEO of SimCorp Incorporated. It's a company that's involved in cybersecurity ventures, and it's based right here in Northwest Indiana. Our colleague Michael Puente talked with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. recently about the issue of casinos in the region and the impact of proposed gaming in Illinois, but that wasn't the only topic that Mike wanted the mayor to address in that conversation.
I do have to ask you this before we get off the line here. There's been a lot of discussion about you possibly taking on Pete Visclosky for the U.S. representative seat. Where are you at in that decision making?
Well, I can tell you that the speculation was fueled mostly by a public records request that the congressman dumped on my office last week. His campaign committee is asking for 15 years worth of data from the city of Hammond and my payroll information and, you know, I mean, so I posted it on social media because I thought it was very unusual and it fueled a lot of speculation. But I can tell you, Michael, that right now I'm keeping my head down. I have elections on November 5th, even though I'm not on the ballot. I have a team of people that I'm supporting that I feel I need to do everything I can to make sure that they're successful on November 5th. And then we're going to be in the process of combining all the records that the congressman's requesting of the city of Hammond. And, I'm not very thrilled about that, by the way. I think it's sort of unusual for a congressman to probe a local mayor. God bless him. He's following the law. We will comply with the law. I just think that that action by Congressman Visclosky's campaign committee fueled a lot of speculation that why is he looking so close at me? Is he afraid that I may run? It's interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, what if you were to run? First of all, what do you think, keeping this a casino theme, what are the odds of you running? And also, what are some of the issues that are close to you that you feel that perhaps needs more attention in Congress from this area?
I can tell you, as an American, which I am, and I have fought for my right to be able to say the things that I'm going to say, is I look at our representatives, not just Pete, and I see people that aren't willing to work with each other, people that aren't willing to do the job that we gave them. We're sending them to Washington, D.C. to get stuff done, to legislate, not to investigate. And it seems to me that, you know, we are a little focused on trying to take down the president. The president's a little focused on trying to stay in office. And to me, it seems like nobody's doing the job we sent them there for. And that's concerning because America needs help right now. And I'm not just talking about Pete Visclosky. I'm talking about the whole bunch of them. And I'm unsatisfied with what's happening in Washington, D.C. And that's me as an American. And I don't think Pete appreciates when I speak out loud like that, and I do. And he's going to have to get used to it because I sat in a submarine for 4 years so that I could say the things that I'm saying right now. And I'm not going to, you know, forfeit my First Amendment rights to be a good Democrat.
That's Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. on a recent off-mic Friday program here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Hoosier Environmental Council is sponsoring a workshop this evening involving solar energy, and you're invited to attend. The meeting will be at the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue University Northwest, starting at 7 o'clock this evening. And to tell us more about the importance of solar energy and how you can get involved and find out more, we have Jesse Carbonda. He's in charge of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And Jesse, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Always great to be with you, Chris.
Well, solar energy is so important these days. Wind energy, of course, is too. And wind energy certainly is the thing that you see the most, at least around Northwest Indiana, with all of the windmills that are out here for travelers to take I-65 and some of the side roads on either side of the interstate through the region. But solar energy is becoming more important because we understand it's becoming more and more economical. And is that why we'd like to see people involved personally on the level of solar energy?
Absolutely. Well, Chris, it's an exciting time for people to consider going solar, whether from the standpoint of homeowners or business owners or places of worship or schools or universities or municipalities. And the reason is, as you alluded to, that prices have dropped. In fact, in the last decade, the price per watt of solar has gone down by 65%. And over that 10-year period, there's been a nearly 14-fold of rooftop solar installations across the country. And the reason why we're hosting workshops like we are in Valparaiso is because of the fact that there are a couple of incentives at the state level and at the federal level that are going to phase out, and the economics of solar will change. So we want people to take advantage before those incentives run out.
You've been able to track the advance of solar energy over the years. From where did we start in as far as the complexity and the expense of, say, outfitting a house to be able to take advantage of the power of the sun to where we are today?
Well, everything has become smaller. The panels, they've become thinner, so they are less pronounced on the rooftop. The inverters have become smaller. And, of course, just, again, the overall price is the critical thing. Every element of pricing has gone down over this long period of time.
I know that there's been instances in the Northwest Indiana and elsewhere in the Hoosier State where organizations, and we're talking nonprofits, we're talking churches, we're talking schools, are getting more involved in solar energy. I've heard of almost entire school districts outfitting their buildings to be able to take advantage of solar energy and saving a lot of money for the patrons of the school district and the taxpayers in general.
It's pretty amazing. I had the fortune of being at ribbon cutting recently, and they were stating that next to teachers' salaries, the second highest operating cost for schools is energy. And you rightly point out that some schools have effectively solarized, one in northeast Indiana in the town of Fremont, one in central Indiana called Sheridan. And the one in Sheridan claims that they will be able to save somewhere between $4 to $5 million over the course of a 20-year period because they're basically locking in the price of their energy through a contract with the utility.
Tell us more about the participants involved in this evening's workshop. It's going to happen at the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue University Northwest there in Valparaiso. Tell us who all is involved in this and what the people who come out to the event starting at 7 o'clock this evening will find out.
Right. Well, really, it's an opportunity for folks to learn about the costs, the technology, and the incentives for going solar. That's the thrust and heart of the presentation. We'll have a really seasoned solar installer there giving that presentation. We'll have a second person coming up from Ancilla College, a small faith-based college, who will be talking about some pretty impressive projects at both Ancilla College itself as well as a Mennonite church in South Bend, and then we'll have Hoosier Environmental Council, including myself, talking about public policy.
And if anybody would like some more information here in the hours that are left before the workshop takes place this evening, how can they find out more about the presentation? And are there any others as well, too, that are going to be aimed up here at Northwest Indiana over time?
Well, there definitely will be. As far as 2019 is concerned, this is our one and only workshop in Northwest Indiana in Valparaiso. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's going to be at 7 o'clock tonight at the Gabus Arboretum. And folks can get more information and register by going to facebook.com/HECWEB. And they'll get they'll go to the events link there, and they'll find that event right up there.
Well, Jesse, thank you for spending time with us to tell us about the event coming up this evening at the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest in Valparaiso. It's an important opportunity for citizens and business people and nonprofit organizations, too, to learn more about the power of solar energy. If you weren't aware about how economical it has become to be able to outfit a building or series of buildings for solar energy these days. And we hope that you have good attendance this evening and looking forward to more of the workshops in the future.
Thank you, Chris. We really appreciate it.
Jesse Carbonda is the Chief Executive Officer of the Hoosier Environmental Council. It'll be months before a final decision comes in Attorney General Curtis Hill's disciplinary case over allegations that he groped four women. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith told us about what's coming out after last week's four-day series of hearings.
The nearly week-long hearing featured 26 witnesses, hours of testimony, and dozens of pieces of evidence. All that must be compiled into one record both sides review. The parties then file what's called their proposed findings with the hearing officer, former State Supreme Court Justice Myra Selby. All of that will probably take a couple months, and at that point, things are in Selby's hands for a while. She'll make a recommendation on what should happen to Curtis Hill, which could be anything from no action to a reprimand, probation to suspension of his license, to disbarment. But that's not the end. Whichever side doesn't like Selby's recommendation petitions the Indiana Supreme Court to review the case. The five justices will make the final decision, but it will likely be well into 2020 before they do. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
It's time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Eye on the Arts is Amy Davis Neverdowskis, who is the executive director of the Art Barn, my new favorite place to go. I just loved that day we had back in the summer when we had lunch there. It was just charming,
it was
and
a
the little
really great
chipmunk
day.
Running up my leg. I screamed like a girl. But I do that all the time. Anyway, Amy, you have a holiday event coming up.
We do.
Well, let's talk about it.
Yes. This is the first year that we are having this event, and we're calling it the Holiday Gift Gallery.
Yes.
And, yeah.
This is not a one-day event.
No, it's basically going to be an exhibition, but it's kind of like mm-hmm. a market too.
Sure.
So it's going to be a lot of small items mm-hmm. that people can
affordable art.
Yes,
that's appropriate for gift giving.
Exactly,
yes.
You got it.
So it starts on November the 19th,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
what will happen on that day?
So well, it opens on that day. So there's not going to be big fanfare on that particular day, but
okay.
it will be open and people can start coming
shopping.
In and shopping.
Mm-hmm.
The opening is going to be on the 22nd of November
okay.
from 5 to 7. And
okay.
so people can come to the opening, meet the artists, and then they can stay.
That's a Friday evening.
Yeah, they can stay for our open mic that Friday evening.
I see.
Because that's a fourth Friday.
Now, usually when somebody is interested in buying a piece of art from an exhibit, they have to wait to take it home until after the show's over. Is that going to be the case?
That is not the case.
I thought perhaps that was not the case.
They can walk away with the item. So.
And then you're going to replenish your stock.
We'll replenish our stock, or we'll kind of move things around and mm-hmm. keep things looking nice as the stock kind of dwindles down. So
does the show run then through the holidays?
Yeah, it'll run through the holiday, and it should be coming down probably about January 9th-ish mm-hmm. is about when we'll plan to take it down. So
I think it's a clever idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah.
And so this is a new event.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the artists get all of the money? The Art Barn gets some of the money?
So yeah, we're doing it on a consignment basis.
Yeah.
So a little bit of the money comes to Art Barn, mm-hmm. but a majority of it goes back to the artists.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come in and make a purchase, you're either supporting local artisans and artists as well as art programming. So
mm-hmm.
when you think about, you know, well, why should I come to Art Barn and, you know, why should I go here instead of some other place that has artistic items?
Mm-hmm.
It's because you're supporting artists and art programs in your community,
mm-hmm.
so it's a really great great way to support.
That's a good thing.
Support artists.
Well, you get a commission probably for selling art from your regular exhibits as well, don't you?
We do. We take
yeah.
about a 30% commission.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
Yeah.
And you deserve it. You have so Art Barn primarily the primary activity of Art Barn is teaching, is classes.
Yeah, educational mission.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all kinds of different classes, and we run sessions throughout the year. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have a very primarily educational mission.
Yeah,
so.
And you have a nice new ceramics program.
We do. Yeah. That's
going
taken
well.
Off. Yeah, it's going really well.
Yeah, for us too. It's just amazing how popular ceramics are currently, and I hope that they remain so.
I do too.
People seem to have they really bond as a group of students.
Yeah.
Regardless of age group.
Yeah.
They really seem to enjoy doing it together. So the artist will be there on the Friday the 22nd.
Yes. Yes.
And you'll have nice wine and cheese.
Yes, we'll have some nice refreshments and nibbles for people to enjoy. They can meet artists, and then after the opening, people can stay for our open mic So Tim Rounds, who's sort of popular in Michigan City for his open mic events, he's going to be hosting, and so we'll have a nice lineup of performers scheduled, and people can enjoy the music. Usually, we have a pretty good lineup of people that play acoustic. There's usually quite a few people that read. So we have poets, storytellers. Sometimes we have some people that, tell jokes, but much more rarely. Usually it's spoken word and music.
So you do this on a monthly basis?
Yes.
Once a month?
Yeah, fourth Fridays.
Okay.
So
this is, that's great. So
yeah.
That sounds like fun. Well, that sounds like a good way to spend a Friday evening.
Yeah.
And I wish you much success with this new holiday art sale.
Yeah, thank you
that
so much.
That sounds great. Thanks for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with a new edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear all the Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can join us next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.